Bienvenidos to our latest edition of Corazón Bilingüe. Join us as we explore the dynamics of language, culture, and the art of poetry. I'm your host, Brenda Nettles Rojas. Con este programa, exploramos la dinámica del lenguaje, la cultura y la creación poética, sometimes in English y a veces en español. Our program fluctuates between English and Spanish. We are here today with Jose Alvarez, who is a creative nonfiction writer. Thank you for joining us today, Jose.
You're welcome.
Now, Jose, you came from Cuba in 1960, and you've traveled all over the world, and you've now been writing about your experiences, a lot of them focused on Cuba.
Yes, indeed. That's kind of what drives me to write, my experience of having left Cuba and not being able to go back.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because that whole sense of place is ingrained in so much writing, that whole concept. And you were talking a little bit before the program about leaving it and then going back, and that really prompted your writing about it.
Yes. I think my first attempt at writing was when I finally, after 30-some years, I went back to Cuba and visited the area where I lived and places that I knew, and that sense of nostalgia, if you wish, is what prompted me. Well, I want to record this. I want to write about the experience of going back and meeting with friends that I hadn't met and hadn't seen in nearly 40 years.
And how do you incorporate that whole sense of that returning to a place that you've left so many years?
Well, that's what I attempt to do when I write, talk about the sense of, part of it is the sense of place, the sense of what are the things that I remember, and a lot of them had to do with the sights and the sounds and the smells of where I grew up. Part of it has to do with the people, and although most of my friends left. So when I went back, I didn't have many friends to look up and to spend time with. So I think it's more of an inner drive in me to say, okay, how do I explain? How do I deal with this sense of loss, if you wish?
Right. Do you think it's a way of reclaiming the country you left?
I think it is. I think it's a way to reclaim it, yes. Yeah. So, in fact, there's a couple of things here that I've written that may...
I would love to hear it, yes. Please share with us.
This one I'm going to read in Spanish. I have another piece in English, but this one is from when I first arrived to work in Tel Aviv. And it's called Cena en el Restaurante Dixie. Ya llevo una semana trabajando en Tel Aviv, una ciudad bulliciosa, animada y llena de vitalidad. Está situada a orillas del mar Mediterráneo y tiene un clima tan fogoso como su gente. Al cabo de una semana trabajando en Tel Aviv, decido explorar la ciudad el viernes por la mañana. El centro comercial está lleno de gente disfrutando del fin de semana. En la calle Dizengoff encuentro un café con mesas al aire libre y me siento a desayunar. El jugo de naranja recién exprimido está dulcísimo, los croissants recién salidos del horno están calientes y el café, aromático, fuerte y amargo, está delicioso. Un gran inicio para mi primer día de descanso en Israel. La ciudad me recuerda a La Habana, donde nací y me crié hasta 1960, cuando salí a un exilio inesperado. Pero no me sorprende, pues hasta el día de hoy casi todo me recuerda a La Habana de mi juventud. El ambiente que encuentro me parece muy similar a La Habana de los años 50. Los cubanos no tenemos conversaciones, sino discusiones acaloradas, así como los israelíes. Los cubanos nos interrumpimos mutuamente para asegurarnos que nuestros puntos de vista siempre se imponen, así como los israelíes. Los cubanos hablamos con las manos, tanto como con la boca, así como los israelíes. Hasta la arquitectura de Tel Aviv me luce familiar. Las casas están pintadas de colores claros y ambas ciudades muestran influencias del modernismo en la arquitectura del siglo XX. Después de desayunar, continúo mi exploración de la ciudad caminando por la calle Allenby, donde encuentro en un estrecho estrecho callejón una librería que vende libros en hebreo y en español. Entro y el dueño me saluda en hebreo. Le contesto en español y me responde con un acento que me suena argentino. Me cuenta que su nombre es Daniel y que emigró a Israel del Uruguay a principios de los años 60. Entró en el ejército israelí y luchó en la guerra de junio del 67. Hablamos de su vida en Israel y de su afición a la literatura latinoamericana. Le encantan los poemas de José Martí. Le cuento cómo disfruté estudiar en mi bachillerato los versos sencillos de Martí, algunos de ellos inmortalizados en los Estados Unidos por la canción Guantanamera. Cuando se entera que nací en Cuba y que me gusta leer misterios, me recomienda algunos libros de Daniel Chavarría, autor uruguayo, cuyos misterios toman lugar en La Habana. Decido comprar un par de ellos, Adiós Muchachos y Lo que dura, dura. Llegan otros clientes y Daniel los atiende en hebreo. Encuentro un par de libros más, Una historia de amor y oscuridad de Amos Oz, autor israelí, y Misterios de La Habana de Zoe Valdés, otra exiliada cubana residente en París, quien narra cuentos de eventos y personajes históricos, enardecidos con su fértil imaginación. Compro mis libros y me despido de Daniel. Satisfecho con el éxito de mi expedición, camino hacia el mar. Al llegar a la playa, me quito los zapatos y remango mis pantalones para entrar en el Mediterráneo hasta mis tobillos. El agua de mar me refresca los pies mientras camino por el litoral de Tel Aviv hasta mi hotel. Por la noche bajo a cenar al restaurante del hotel y me encuentro un menú muy limitado por el comienzo del Shabbat, el día de descanso para los judíos que comienza al anochecer del viernes. En el hotel pido direcciones a algún restaurante que preste menos atención a los dictámenes religiosos. La joven recepcionista, con pistola al cinto, me recomienda el Dixie en la calle Igal Alon. Allí voy a cenar, acompañado de los misterios de La Habana. El Dixie está lleno de gente joven. Creo que soy el comensal más viejo en el restaurante y recuerdo los comentarios del padre Eduardo Barrios en la misa del crucero del 2000, celebrando el 40º aniversario de nuestra graduación del Colegio de Belén en La Habana. Nos decía Lalito, ya pasamos la mitad del camino. Nos queda menos por vivir de lo que ya hemos vivido. No hay mesas disponibles, así que me siento en el bar. Pido un vino tinto y un plato de carne de puerco, lo más cercano que encuentro a lechón asado y arroz con frijoles. A mi lado, una pareja disfruta una cena de mariscos en animada discusión hebrea, llena de sonidos guturales y de gesticulaciones que ponen en peligro mi copa de vino. La música de fondo, Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, Whitney Houston y otros que no reconozco, me ofrece una alternativa a la cacofonía del idioma hebreo hablado a volumen cubano. Mientras espero por mi cena, Zoe Valdés me recuerda a algunos personajes que conozco desde la niñez. Matías Pérez parte para siempre de La Habana en un globo, anticipando a los balseros. Alexander von Humboldt toma un café con Mama Inés, la del café. Cirilo Villaverde pasea en Quitrín por La Habana con su esposa, acompañados por Cecilia Valdés y un escritor francés, Eugène Sue. Heredia vuelve a Cuba del exilio, pero las autoridades le dificultan la entrada al país y solo tiene tiempo para conversar por unos minutos con su amigo, Domingo del Monte, que le ha ido a esperar al muelle y a quien nunca más volverá a ver. Unos niños revolucionarios simulan violentamente un fusilamiento frente al monumento a los 8 estudiantes de medicina ejecutados por los españoles a fines del siglo XIX. Maceo tiene un encuentro erótico con un joven en el Hotel Inglaterra frente al Parque Central. Aquí, sentado en un restaurante israelí, lleno de gente hablando en hebreo, un idioma que no entiendo, y leyendo en español cuentos de personajes cubanos, desconocidos fuera del ámbito cubano, me siento aislado y solo. Pienso que mi país, ese país que Cristóbal Colón describió como la tierra más hermosa que ojos humanos han visto, no es más que una cuna de exiliados, nómadas y desterrados. Llega mi cena y mientras leo un cuento sobre José Martí, la música de fondo cambia a ritmos caribeños. Un cubano entona, Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Guantanamera, Guajira, Guantanamera. Yo soy un hombre sincero de donde crece la palma. Y antes de morir, me quiero echar mis versos del alma. Y sonrío. Cuba es y ha sido por mucho tiempo cuna de exiliados, nómadas y desterrados. Pero la música cubana es conocida en el mundo entero. Aquí en Israel me siento feliz. Me siento en casa.
Qué bonita historia.
Pero todo me trae de vuelta al asunto de Cuba y no estar en Cuba. Y
sí, muy
estar...
interesante que uno puede dejar el país, pero el país no lo deja.
No lo deja. Yeah, you're right. That's the...
You can leave a country, your place, your homeland, yeah. But yet you carry it with you. Because here you are, world away,
yeah.
And different people, different scenes, but yet there's all these memories and there's reminders of Cuba.
Oh, yeah,
I love that, what you said, la Habana de mi juventud.
Yeah,
You carry that with you.
And that's part of the sadness, because that Havana no longer exists. And so, you know, the only place it exists is in my head,
in
the head of my
and now in
the
your
people
stories.
I grew up with. And that's the drive to write.
Very interesting, indeed. And now I noticed that because you mentioned this piece was in Spanish, and you mentioned that you also write in English.
Mm-hmm.
What determines the language? I'm always interested in what when a writer decides to write in one language or another.
Well, I think what drives me to drive in one language or the other is I feel very comfortable in Spanish. So when I want to write something personal like this piece about those experiences, I write it in Spanish. But when I want to be able to read for, you know, an audience, or I want to perhaps get some feedback on what I'm writing, and because I live in the United States, I often wind up writing in English so that I can get some feedback, which otherwise I couldn't get. I was mentioning earlier that I lived in the Netherlands for a few years, and there I was in a group of people who, a group of writers, you know,
right.
We saw ourselves as writers. And there, the Dutch people were writing in English. I was writing in English. There were people from Argentina who were writing in English. And part of the reason was that that was a common language that we could communicate. We could give feedback to each other about the work that we were writing. And so, in that sense, that drives me to write in English.
Right. The audience.
The audience.
Knowing that who was going to be reading.
Who's going to be reading it.
Your work. But your first choice, you said, would be Spanish because you're more comfortable in it.
I think so. And my wife tells me she enjoys my writing in Spanish better. So when she's the audience, I write for her in Spanish.
Now, do you see a difference in your style when you write in one language or the other?
Yeah, I think it's... there's a theme in that, and that is that even in Spanish there are so many different versions of Spanish. So when I write in Spanish, I'm writing in Cuban Spanish, and when I speak, people who listen to me, even though I haven't lived in Cuba for 50 years, you're from Cuba. So the way I write in Spanish is kind of coming out from a Cuban experience. And in English, I think I'm more analytical, more less emotion. The connotations between words are not as well established in my mind as in Spanish. I mean, I think about it more. So it's more cool, more analytical.
Right, as opposed to the Spanish, it's just, it's
more emotional.
Interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, there was one line where earlier you said, where I grew up doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
That's a very sad
concept. It is sad.
And you mentioned that you had returned to
and that's the one piece that I wanted to read a little from, because it's in English, and
that's
on my first trip to go back. There was sadness, and it really doesn't exist. So I titled this story "A Cuban Sunset."
A Cuban Sunset.
And here goes. The last time Raul and I had met was in May 1960 at our high school graduation from Colegio de Belén in Havana, the same high school from which Fidel Castro graduated in the mid-1940s. Raul and I had been classmates for 7 years, and we had played shortstop and second base in the school's baseball team, but we did not socialize after school. Most of the graduating class of 1960 at our school left the country fleeing the revolution. Only four chose to stay in Cuba. Raul was one of them. I left Cuba the following August to go to college in Detroit, expecting to return to Havana for my vacation at the end of my freshman year. However, relations between the U.S. and Cuba worsened during that winter and spring, and I did not make it back. After college and graduate school, I worked for a major international company for over 30 years. Raul stayed in Cuba, supporting the revolution, and became a member of the Cuban Communist Party. The state paid for his engineering studies in Bratislava. Upon his return to Cuba, he worked for the state for over 30 years. As I grew older, my desire to go back grew stronger. I wanted to walk the streets of my old neighborhood in downtown Havana, to enter La Lucha, the men's clothing store my parents had owned, and to walk up the spiral staircase to the mezzanine where we lived. I wanted to watch the waves jumping over the seawall of El Malecón and smell the sea, to see the vultures that soar with thermal currents forecasting the coming of a thunderstorm, to feel the tropical rain, to see the fields of sugarcane, to drink sugarcane juice, to lie on the beach. I wanted to meet with my old friends and relatives I had not seen in many years. I wanted to go home again. Bureaucracies on both sides of the Strait of Florida made it difficult to go to Cuba. The Cuban government made travel to Cuba difficult for people like me who left the country after Castro came to power. The U.S. imposed restrictions for travel to the island for all American citizens. I waited in vain for the U.S. and Cuba to improve relations. I waited for Castro to die of old age, but having passed my 50th birthday, I was afraid that I might die before him and go to my grave without ever going back. I decided to wait no more. I planned a trip with my wife for June 1997. It was time for me to return to the place where I was born. Through Emilio, a mutual friend who lives in the United States but has returned to Cuba many times since he left in 1961, I got Raul's phone number and called him prior to my trip so we could meet. We had not talked since the day we graduated, but we enjoyed our few minutes on the phone. He told me he was undergoing treatment for cancer, but he was feeling better, had plenty of free time, and looked forward to meeting with me. The morning after my arrival, I attempted to reach him again on the phone, unsuccessfully. It had rained heavily, and the phones were not working in his building. The next day, I drove to his house near La Fuente Luminosa, a lighted water fountain less reverently known as Paulina's Bidet, after a former first lady. I walked up the 5 flights of stairs to his apartment and knocked on the door. He opened the door and I immediately recognized him and his ever-present smile. It was that smile I remembered when I had imagined seeing him again. I had been afraid that the years and the cancer might have erased that smile and was glad they had not. We met his wife Vivian and his children, Victor and Elena. Vivian prepared coffee for all of us. Raul told me of his earlier marriage to Sonia, an engineering student from Bratislava he met at school. That marriage had ended in divorce when they moved to Cuba after graduating from college. She missed her country and her family so much that she decided to return to Bratislava with her children. We invited him and his family to lunch at El Aljibe, a local restaurant for customers paying in dollars. The cost per person was $15, 3/4 of his monthly salary. They enjoyed the lunch and made sure to take the leftovers home for another meal. Cubans who do not have access to dollars make do with the rationing cards for their allotment of food prescribed by the government. They also have free medical care and subsidized housing, utilities, and public transportation. The next day, we walked through my neighborhood of Central Havana. We drove to Chinatown and ate at a Cuban Chinese restaurant. Finally, we had some drinks at El Patio, an outdoor cafe by the cathedral, while listening to live music. Most colonial buildings and fortresses in old Havana have been renovated and are in very good shape. The old church of San Francisco de Paula is now a museum open to the public. Local musicians now play chamber music in a small theater, formerly the chapel where friars attended mass. There is a nominal admission fee for Cubans and a steeper tourist admission fee for foreigners. We all went in as Cubans. Across the bay, the Moro Castle and La Cabaña, old fortresses that for centuries protected the harbor from pirates and warships from nations at war with Spain, are now tourist attractions. In a centuries-old tradition, dating back to the time when the doors of the walled city were closed every night till the next morning, a cannon salvo was fired from La Cabaña announcing that it is 9 p.m. Now this Cañonazo de las Nueve is performed by Cuban soldiers in 18th century military uniforms to the applause of the audience. When I went to the ceremony, I was surprised to see some of the soldiers seeking tips from the tourists. But the section of Central Havana where I grew up is in shambles. There has been very little effort to maintain this part of the city. The government has chosen to invest in other areas. Driving through the narrow streets, sometimes we had to ride on the sidewalks to avoid the rubble from buildings that had collapsed. We also drove through the necropolis, El Cementerio de Colón, where the streets were clean, the curbs painted in white, and the grassy areas lush and freshly mowed. I thought, they take better care of the neighborhood for the dead than of the neighborhoods for the living. I felt very sad about Raúl's situation. We both had studied engineering, and each of us had worked for many years for a single enterprise, he for the Cuban government, I for AT&T. Yet he had little to show for his lifetime dedication to the revolution. They can't afford to eat meat, only soy substitutes. His children have a good education, paid for by the state, but there are no opportunities to work other than for the government. His son told me, "My father's generation failed us. This system does not work." However, we don't want the exile groups in the U.S. to come in and try to tell us how to change. We must do it ourselves. They live in a small apartment where electricity is often unavailable, as is the water that must be pumped up to a water tank on the building's roof. The revolution that started with such high ideals, eliminating corruption, gambling, prostitution, and seeking independence from tourism, has wound up 40 years later with a caste system. Those who have access to dollars and those who do not. Raúl told me the story of a friend of his, Dr. Velasco, who was invited to give a talk at a medical symposium in Havana. His talk was very well received, and after the conference, one of the foreign doctors, Dr. Klein, sought him out to discuss his presentation. The next day, when Dr. Klein went to El Aljibe with his Cuban host, he was surprised to see Dr. Velasco as one of the valet parking attendants, and asked him why he was working as a valet. Dr. Velasco replied that he needed the dollars. I felt sad for myself as well. The country I left does not exist anymore. I like the land and I like the people, but I don't like the political system. After living in the U.S. for so many years, I'd find it very difficult to give up the freedoms I enjoy here. People in Cuba have to ask permission to move from the countryside to Havana. The police regularly ask citizens for their identity cards, and if they're not in the region where they belong, they're sent back. I'd like to go back and perhaps retire there in my old age, but not with the current government. Many Cubans in exile vilify those of us who have chosen to go back. Only a few of my graduating class of 1960 have returned. Yet most of us who have gone back have met with Raúl. When we were ready to leave, Victor told me, "You must have had something very special at your school. 10 of your classmates have come to visit my father. We'd like you to take with you these medals that my father received at Belén. I imagine you did not take yours with you when you left." Raúl's medals for excellence in science, excellence in mathematics, and good conduct are displayed on my study room wall. In November, Raúl was buried.
What a way to capture a return.
Yeah.
And so many memories. And
so many. Yeah.
So, but it's not just about memories. It's about reality.
Yeah, yeah.
That, I mean, past and present.
Yeah.
So you've worked both into your piece.
Well, that's what I try to do. I try to capture the feeling that goes with not just the visual aspect or the smells or just the strong feelings that go with it.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's wonderful that you were able to visit.
Yeah.
But at the same time, with that joy of visiting comes that reality of meeting a different Cuba on your return.
Yeah, yeah. It'll never be the same.
Well, Jose, it's been a real pleasure in talking to you about your writing. Mm-hmm. What are some of your future projects that you're working on? I know that, again, Cuba is a recurring theme, but I know that you also address a lot of other topics as well.
Yeah, I think from a writing viewpoint, I want to continue doing this kind of writing of personal essays, and I've done some travel to Spain, and my father was born there, and so I have a lot of ties and a lot of sense of family roots there, and I've been writing a little bit about that. And the other thing is I would like to continue some fiction work that I began to write a few years ago. And it takes more planning, it takes more effort, and I've just began to return to it and want to see if I can push it along a little bit further.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Jose. We've been talking to Jose Alvarez, who is a creative nonfiction writer. He came to the United States in the 1960s and has traveled all over the world and is now putting a lot of these stories on the paper. So,
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the time we spent here together today.
Thank you. You are listening to Corazón Bilingüe. We invite you to join us again as we continue our conversation on language, culture, and the art of poetry. Los invitamos que nos acompañen de nuevo, mientras que sigamos explorando la dinámica del lenguaje, la cultura. If you would like to hear more, visit us at www.corazonbilingue.com. Gracias por acompañarnos.